The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, our affiliate stations, or CJSR.
Hello all, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. So it's been said that children are our future. And although it's a pretty crappy song lyric, it does happen to be true. So whether out of altruism or in order to save our own collective butts, we need to ensure that the next generation is thoroughly prepared for all of the irrationality, pseudoscience, and disinformation that this world will throw at them, which is a lot. But how exactly do we do that? So today's episode is all about skeptical education. Our feature interview will be with Daniel Loxton, editor and illustrator of Junior Skeptic magazine, and he'll be with us a little later in the show. We also have our own resident skeptical parent in the studio with us today, Brad Solomons. Hello, Brad.
Hello.
Brad's the creator of the Skeptad blog, otherwise known as Raising Kids to Use Their Brains. Welcome back, Brad.
Hi.
So what are you talking about today?
Well, I am going to talk a little bit about the wonderful world of fear-based marketing, specifically fear-based marketing towards parents. And that is just an amazing little topic. If you are a parent, you probably know most of this already because you've been to the toy store and seen this. But I guess for the non-parents out there, it is a real interesting eye-opener to see what kind of stuff goes on to try and target parents to really get afraid.
Oh, yeah. They're vulnerable.
Oh, yeah. My daughter and I took a wander over to the local toy store. I won't name names, but we wandered the aisles for a bit, and based on my own experience and what we saw there, we picked out a few products that are really targeted as safety products. But you know, when you're really looking at the safety products, do you really, you know, what defines safety versus, you know, you just fear, you know, why you buy this because you have to be afraid. And so I picked out five, and I'll go into those in a little bit. But you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about what a fear-based marketing is. So really, you're a new parent, you've just had a kid, you're insanely afraid of what the future is going to bring with that child, and so you go to the store, or people go to the store on your behalf and buy all sorts of necessary things, I guess, like you need, you know, diapers and you need whatever else. But then there's this list of other little products that can add up really quickly that they tell you need, because otherwise, you're a bad parent.
You're a bad parent.
You don't want to be a bad parent. And that's the other thing. If something goes wrong, you know, you could have bought this $20 little gadget that would have stopped it. Just what if? But, you know, golly, if I'd only bought that, we'd all be safe. But, you know, that's fear-based marketing towards parents. So to give you a few examples. Oh, and I do have a little bit of a caveat. Some of these, you know, I'm sure all of them were invented because somewhere out there is a legitimate need for them. But does every parent need them? Probably not. Probably not. So
good caveat.
Starting at the low end of the scale, for about $6, you can get what's called the bath pal thermometer, which is a little duck-shaped thermometer you stick in the bathtub. And, you know, the whole idea is that, you know, you can't trust your own sense of telling when the water's too hot. You know, you're going to stick that baby in there and they're going to be scalded and burnt, and you know, you're going to be in the hospital and you're going to accidentally deep fry your child. But you know, in reality, even the package says on it, you know, test the water with your hand first. So you know, it's really just you're getting this because you have to be afraid that you don't know how to bath your child. So you know, and it's in the shape of a toy. It's a rubber duck, and a thermometer is not a fun toy. So
that's great. Okay.
Number two is the finger guard, which is a plastic guard for your door, so you can't accidentally slam your door on your fingers on your kid's fingers. I guess this is to prevent you from chopping your child's fingers off in the door. I don't know if I've ever heard of a case of that actually happening.
I was thinking, how hard would you have to slam a door?
Well, that's just it. Like, even if you slam it on your hands, it might hurt for a little bit, but you know, isn't that a learning experience for your child? Like, don't stick your finger in doors. And, you know, that's my thought. Anyways, number three, the and on the similar vein, the and I've seen these on people's tables when I go over to friends' houses, and they've got their corner guards and edge guards for coffee tables. So basically, you take your nice coffee tables and you stick plastic padding on the edges of them with like double-sided tape, and so you go, yeah, it's your kid is toddling around the house and they're just learning to walk, and you know, because you're not watching them when this is happening, they're off doing it on their own apparently, but you know, they wander over and they smack their head on the corner of the table, and I don't know. It's another one of those, do you really, really need that? And then we get into the really crazy stuff, like the super yard, which is essentially it's like a dog pen for your child. You go in your backyard and you set up this is about 20-foot ring of 3-foot high fence, and you lock your children in it, and they can play safely in their backyard in a confined space. And,
you know, I can see years of therapy bills.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, so much for the freedom of childhood. You know, what are you teaching your children here? What are you teaching them that they need to be protected at all times?
Right.
And
that they're fragile.
Yeah, they're fragile, and they need to be in a safe little yard where not even the dangers of their own yard can get to them.
A yard within your yard. That's mm-hmm. really going one step too far, I think.
Yes, yes. And then we get to number five, which is for about $150, you can buy what's called the Angel Care Movement and Sound Monitor, which this is taking the baby monitor to the next step. A lot of people have the little baby monitors where you put the radio transmitter in the room, and you take a little receiver down, and you can go sit and watch TV, and if the child wakes up and starts bawling their head off and you can't hear them because they're 3 floors away or whatever, cool, you hear them. Well, this one, it is a little mattress pad that goes down, and if the baby stops moving for more than 5 minutes, its clacks and sound goes off, and it's marketed as, you know, prevents SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, and this is a serious thing, but it's mostly linked to, there's a number of causes that it's linked to, and you can look it up on the internet. There's numerous speculations of why this happens, and so they market this as, you know, if you don't want your child to have SIDS, you know, to die in their sleep, to do this. And this alarm will go off if they stop moving. But the problem is that only a small percentage of kids actually don't or move around in their sleep. So a lot of kids just lay there limp and sleep all night. And so every 15 minutes, this alarm is going off, freaking out parents. And 90% of these things probably go back to the store. And you spend $150 on it and probably don't get your full money back.
But the idea is, if you don't buy this mm-hmm. and your child dies of SIDS,
that's the problem.
You have effectively killed your baby.
And there's this new societal guilt.
God.
Yes, this new societal guilt that, you know, you have to buy this stuff, otherwise you're a bad parent.
And you know, we might as well call social services now because you're obviously not fit. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem is new parents are so vulnerable to mm-hmm. these kind of things. Like, new parents are the kind of people who, you know, they see a mole on their kids and, oh, God, it's cancer.
Exactly. And it's this culture of fear that we're creating. And I think it's the exact opposite of what we're trying to do. We want to build independence in kids and teach them not to be afraid of the world and to take risks. And that's where we want to go, and that's how we get people to think independently and rationally, and that's what I write about on my blog all the time, and this just drives me bonkers seeing these products out there.
Well, do you think, though, that this is sort of a piece of a larger puzzle in terms of, you know, there's fear-based marketing, and mm-hmm. I'm just thinking we're definitely involved in a fear-based culture, right? Like Amber Alert to anyone.
Definitely.
That's what I'm
definitely,
saying.
Definitely.
There's a terrorist around every
and
corner.
And in 30 years, I can foresee, you know, maybe this is just a wild speculation, but worst case scenario, we're all going to be walking around with helmets on because we're afraid of the world hitting us on the head and, you know, rubber padding our kids so they grow up in a safe, protected world.
Well, I'm depressed. Thank you, as always, Brad, for coming on the show. And if you out there, want to appear on Skeptically Speaking to talk about science, skepticism, critical thought, etc., please do send us an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Just put speaking up in the subject line, briefly pitch us a topic, and we'll get back to you. And we'll also be right back to speak to Daniel Loxton about how to provide children with a solid foundation in reality right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
You're back with Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We are on the line today with Daniel Loxton, the editor of Skepticism's premier critical thinking publication for kids, Junior Skeptic, which is bound into every issue of the Skeptic magazine. So in addition to writing and illustrating most issues of Junior Skeptic, he's also Skeptic Magazine's resident expert on cryptozoology and monster mysteries. He's also written on subjects from Roswell, the Crystal Skulls for Skeptic, E-Skeptic, Skeptical Briefs, Ascent Magazine, Cryptomundo, and in Finnish translation, Skeptico. He's been featured on the cover of Humanist Perspectives on CBC Radio 1 and is a regular guest on the podcast Skepticality. In 2008, the front page of Canada's National Post reported Daniel's findings regarding an alternative medicine scandal. Daniel is also the author of two illustrated kids' books on evolution. And before joining the editorial staff at Skeptic, Daniel was a professional shepherd for 9 years. And thanks, Daniel, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So I do have to ask, and you probably get asked this all the time, but how did you go from sheep herding to the editor of a skeptical kids magazine? It's not usually considered a natural progression, I wouldn't think.
Well, you know, for myself and for my brothers who are also involved in skepticism, it's more natural than you would guess. We used to, when we were in sheep camp, way up, usually just on the BC side of the Alaska Panhandle, off in the wilderness. We used to, when there was a break, sit on a stump and pull our dirty backpacks off and pull out tattered copies of Skeptic magazine. So I'd been following the literature ever since junior high school. And when I finished up art school, I contacted Skeptic Magazine and started doing pro bono work for them, as well as some of the other skeptics and free thought magazines around. And their guy that they had on Junior Skeptic fell through for some reason. I got a shot at one issue, and they loved it, and history was made.
Beautiful. So, okay, good. Can you tell us about Junior Skeptic magazine?
Yeah, absolutely. Junior Skeptic is a 10-page kids section bound into the back of every issue of Skeptic magazine, which is a science and critical thinking magazine that you can buy in any major bookstore, some supermarkets and pharmacies and so on, up here in Canada and, of course, throughout the United States as it's U.S.-based.
So,
Junior Skeptic is aimed for myself in grade 7 is really the audience. A strong reader of about age 10 to 12, 10 to 13 in there somewhere, who is interested in mysteries, has some interest in science, or at least things that go bump in the night, and likes a good story and likes to get to the bottom of things.
Well, I know it was before your time, but do you know why Junior Skeptics started in the first place?
not too far behind before my time. Junior Skeptic. Some of your listeners may know a great thinker by the name of Lisa Simpson, and she was a fan of a fictional magazine called Junior Skeptic, which is based on, it's a little nod to the Real Skeptic magazine. So in a little bit of a recursive circle. Junior Skeptic is based on the fictional Junior Skeptic, which is based on the Real Skeptic.
Which is brilliant. So do you think, I'm just wondering if that was something that, that people were asking Skeptic for, if they could produce something with children in mind?
Absolutely, they were, and you know, that's natural. Every community, you know, and they're particularly a kind of an activist community like the skeptical movement. They look around and they want something to some way to help pass on their values and the information they've amassed to the next generation. So every community ends up looking for some sort of an outreach project for kids. So it was a natural sort of thing. But I don't really think that Skeptic knew quite what they were getting into. I don't. You know, it's running for adults, as many professional skeptics and my bosses included do, is difficult. But writing the same sort of material for kids is a whole different story, particularly because the art is such a burden and overhead and time and cost. So they didn't realize, I don't think, that they were, when they launched Junior Skeptic, I don't think they realized they were creating what would become a full-time position.
Well, good for you.
they did it as a volunteer position for a long time, and it was just too difficult. It takes too long. Those 10 pages really take a couple of months to do. So,
well, so you mainly examine, you know, paranormal claims and monsters and such in Junior Skeptic. Why is that?
That's right. You know, we try to teach science and critical thinking, or promote a scientific worldview, promote curiosity and interest in the world. To do that, we use the paranormal as a kind of a hook. You know, everybody likes a monster. Everybody likes a mystery. Figuring out how you get to the bottom of those things is, you know, it's sort of a soft sell for figuring out how you get to the bottom of anything. You know, how do you learn anything about the world? It has to be, you know, things have to be investigated. Evidence has to be found, and hypotheses have to be weighed. So the same lessons the same techniques apply, the same lessons apply.
And do you think the monsters and such are just more accessible to youth?
Well, I think they're more accessible to everybody. I love monsters, and you know, one of the things we hear very often at Skeptic is people will write to us or will contact me and say, "Oh, you know, I actually read Junior Skeptic." Adults will say this, and I always say, "Well, I don't know why you're looking so sheepish about it." That's true for most of our readers. Most of our adult academic readers read Junior Skeptic, and they do it first. They turn to it as kind of like the, you know, turning to the comic section of the newspaper. And you know, when I was just a reader of Skeptic magazine, I would turn to Junior Skeptic first. You know, it's
because it's
helpful.
The comics.
Yeah, it's
everybody turns to the comics
monsters.
First.
Yeah, you go comics, forum letters,
exactly,
book reviews, and you get to the features last. That's the natural progression.
So, would you say the Junior Skeptic is a bit of a gateway drug?
Well, we aim it to be a gateway into wonder and awe for the majesty of the universe.
That sounds better.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the idea.
So if you guys out there have a question for Daniel about Junior Skeptic, skeptical education, or sheep, apparently, give us a call at 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet at Skeptical Radio. So, back to the gateway drug. You're actually trying to get them even younger and in other languages, right? You wrote a Portuguese language children's book on evolution.
Yeah, we did a few years back, we did a two-part Junior Skeptic, which was rather than monsters, it was just a straight science story on evolution, intro to evolution. And we were shopping that around as a possible book project when we were suddenly contacted by a large outfit in Portugal called the Gulbenkian Foundation, which is a big philanthropic organization like the MacArthur Foundation or something along those lines. And they were doing a huge Darwin 2009 event where they were putting on, I think, the world's largest evolution-themed museum exhibit, plus this huge lecture series convention thing with Niles Eldridge and a lot of other famous scientists. And just as a little footnote for that, they wanted to produce a full-color full color book for kids to distribute to public school students for free. So that's what we did. We licensed it to those guys. It's a whole new layout in full color. It's about 50 pages long. And it went out to thousands of high school, junior high school kids in Portugal for free, which was just a wonderful thing to be part of. But also really complicated, because at the same time we're negotiating with a large Canadian corporate publisher, Kids Can Press, which is the home of Franklin the Turtle. And if you've got any toddlers around, you're familiar with a number of their properties. Big Chorus subsidiary.
If you watch Saturday morning cartoons, you know.
Yeah, if you watch Treehouse, you're familiar.
Right.
And they wanted to license the same material, so it ended up being quite a complex three-way negotiation. But everybody involved really wanted to make the free philanthropic project happen, and it did. So. So the Portuguese version out this past spring, the English language version, which is much expanded, has a lot of new art, new sections, a complete rewrite, will be out this coming spring. And we'll let out more details as we get closer to that.
Okay. And both of these books were based on a two-part series, correct? In Junior Skeptic?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And anyone who wants to... get that sooner. That's available in the back issue section of skeptic.com.
So are there actually other kids' books about evolution? Not as good, of course. Are there others?
Hopefully not quite as good. There are some, but I like to believe that Junior Skeptic is an especially good the format of Junior Skeptic is always an A to Z kind of primer on any topic. So, you know, if we look at Bigfoot, I start by saying, "Woo, what about a monster?" And then I say, "How did that whole legend get started?" And then we go through the entire history and the evolution of it, and then we talk about some of the arguments. So it's, you know, it's a format that's really quite distilled and I think pretty effective. So hopefully it will be twice as effective in full color in book format, so I look forward to reviews.
We'll be doing that, absolutely. But you also actually write for adults. How is that different than writing for kids?
Well, it's a lot easier. You know, if you write for adults, you can say something like, you know, I'm looking at a monster story right now about a very obscure Canadian monster, the Thetis Lake Monster. And I can say something, if I was writing for adults, I could say something like, in 1972, X happened. But when you're writing for kids, they don't know what 1972 was. You have to really, you have to try and describe it somehow. You know, it's the end of the hippie era, and
do you describe bell bottoms?
Not yet. I haven't finalized the copy there yet. In other stories, I've had to, you know, describe things in terms of, you know, while Billy the Kid was riding, or, you know, while Al Capone was ruling Chicago, that kind of thing. You have to, you know, all the kind of background knowledge that adults carry with them. Kids don't have any of that. So there's, you know, you really have to explain a lot. And also, you have to explain it in an extremely distilled way. You know, when I write for adults, I can use a lot of adjectives. All that gets stripped out for kids.
Right.
It just gets distilled right down.
But this isn't about dumbing it down, though, right?
No, and you know, this is where the kind of secret of Junior Skeptic is especially valuable, I think. Junior Skeptic, the primary audience for Junior Skeptic is 50,000 adult academics, and then hopefully as many of their nieces and nephews and children and students as they care to pass it on to.
We're just going to go to a short break. Be right back.
Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking about genomics with Dr. Fintan Steele. Will we soon be able to scan plants and animals at the supermarket based on their genetic barcodes? Can gene therapies leave us looking like the Incredible Hulk? Can you falsify DNA evidence? And if chickpeas have more DNA than me, why am I so much smarter than hummus? Call in and question everything on the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR.
And you're back with Skeptically Speaking. We're talking today with Daniel Loxton, editor of Junior Skeptic Magazine. And again, if you'd like to be involved in the conversation, do call us at 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet at Skeptical Radio. So, actually, a listener sent this in right before the show, and I wanted to bring it up. Thanks, Butterfly Cake, by the way. That's a lovely name. So the article shows that kids are smarter than we assume. And it's Allison Gopnik's research at the U of California has shown that young children, 5 and under, are fully capable of reasoning and assessing probability. But babies' tendency to be interested in just about everything and anything has led many adults to assume that their lack of focus is indicative of unintelligence. And apparently that's not true. Babies just explore and adults audit. So I'm wondering how that relates to writing for kids.
Well, that's a younger demographic than I'm writing for. Mm-hmm. But I'm a parent. I have a son who's 3.5, and he's an awful lot brighter than I might have assumed before I was a parent. I mean, you know, you can think back to your own childhood, and you remember always being smarter and more together than your teachers and parents were giving you credit for. But I'm constantly surprised. Probably most first time parents are with just how on it little kids are. Every day I go and I get my boy from daycare and I carry him home on my shoulders most days, just because I can hear him over the traffic a lot better. And we talk the whole way home and every day he has questions for me. He says, Dad, tell me again about the animal that makes the jewelry, in its spit. And I say, okay, that's an oyster, and I talk more about that. Or, you know, he shows me a corn pop this morning. He says, look, it's just like our Earth. So, yeah, it's just round like the Earth. And, you know, they're just absorbing and processing all the time. And it's a wonderful experience for a parent to be able to know everything for a little while. I know that doesn't last.
For a very short while. I have a 14-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
Now I know nothing.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to that.
No. But you were also the author of Where Do We Go From Here? Amazing essay about the future of skepticism. Now, at one point, you talk about how vital it is that we teach children critical analysis. And I'm just going to read this little bit.
Sure.
The kids in schools today and the adults reading magazines are called upon to navigate unimaginably vast challenges in which millions, even billions of lives hang in the balance. Climate change, peak oil production, dwindling water supplies, the human population peak, unprecedented demographic trends, soaring antibiotic resistance in disease organisms, the AIDS-driven crippling of entire nations. My children will see all of it, and they'll have tough choices to make. These problems are all science problems, and every citizen desperately needs the factual background and cognitive tools required to help solve them. Well, that sounds dire, really.
It does. It does, doesn't it? But that's not really how I look at it. I'm actually tremendously optimistic. I'm no kind of Pollyanna. People around the world are getting hammered now by this stuff, and some of them are going to get hammered a lot worse. But I think that I think the future is navigable, and I think the better armed our citizens are, the higher degree of scientific literacy they can manage, the better their reasoning skills are, then the better prepared we are for that future.
Well, that, yes, that is much more optimistic. Thank you. Because when you think about it like that, it seems daunting. And there's, you know, those are, again, as you were saying, the scientific challenges. But what other sort of skeptical challenges do kids have to deal with?
Well, you know, those are both. It's funny. I deal with this in that essay. On the one hand, you have these kind of vast global problems that require science to solve them, and those are definitely where those are the big money questions. How we deal with those things. Those are, you know, yeah, billions of lives hanging in the balance, and traditionally that's one of the arguments that skeptics have used when arguing for the importance of our project. That, you know, science literacy, you know, is one of the pivots on which civilization rotates, you know. But in that essay, I argue for a renewed skeptical activism to do with much smaller problems, which are, you know, easy to see as trivial, you know, things from things where regular people get hurt and nobody does anything. Things like there are people in this world who sell pretend medicines to sick people. Knowingly sell pretend medicines to the most vulnerable people in our society, there are people who will go for some love advice to a psychic,
right.
and learn that unless they give their life savings to the psychic, she will be unable to prevent the supernatural ill that will, you know, kill their husband next week. That kind of thing, and those kinds of smaller. Less civilization-wide kind of problems are, they're easy for society to overlook, and society tends to, except for skeptics turn our eye that way.
Right. And those small problems definitely lead to the larger ones that we're talking about.
Well, they do. Often they do. And, you know, people are vulnerable to those problems to the extent that their critical thinking faculties are impaired or low, or their scientific literacy is low. But I actually think it's really worthwhile going after those things in themselves. It's like, you know, the existence of mugging will not topple civilization, but it doesn't mean that law enforcement should do nothing about mugging. Somebody should show up. Somebody should do something. So I think that's our role. It's quite narrow, more narrow than some skeptics have proposed. But it's, I think, incredibly important in terms of human cost.
Well, speaking of people doing things, someone has sent us an email.
Yes, this is from Kennedy. It says, just a call to arms. I find that when I find the Skeptic magazine in a convenience store, it is always in the very back of the magazine rack. And I always make a point, even when it's an issue that I've already read, of pulling it out, glancing through, and then innocently leaving in the front of the rack. That is usually a Cosmo or a Maxim that deserves being covered. Pass it on. And P.S. to Daniel, love the Scooby-Doo feature.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Kennedy. I don't know if I can recommend it, but thanks.
I can recommend it.
I'm often tempted to do the same thing. Often you'll see Skeptic and the Skeptical Inquirer much esteemed colleague magazine from the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, will often be with all the paranormal stuff, which is, you know, thematically makes sense, but conceptually it's exactly the opposite of the correct filing.
Right. So, well, let's talk about filing some more. What do you think of the public school system?
The public school system, mm-hmm.
In Canada, specifically.
We are
Canadian on this show today.
I'm a product of the public school system, and I love it. I'm not interested in sending my children anywhere else. I have friends who are involved in the school system, and of course they have complaints, as people do in every industry. Mm-hmm. But you know what an achievement of civilization that every child gets a reasonable shot at a somewhat level playing field. You know, like they get the opportunity to read and do basic arithmetic. Those kinds of things are quite recent breakthroughs for human civilization.
Right.
I think they're hard won and they're important.
Do you think it has the ability to teach children as much as they're going to need to know? Specifically, does it have the ability to teach them to think critically? Well, there's a lot of conversation about whether public school or any school really just teaches you facts as opposed to the ability to think.
Well, you know, it's not a function of the public school model, I don't think, but it's a function of universal access somewhat. Private schools are able to find that their students perform better on average. That's easy to do when you only let in elite students, right? So it's always a struggle for people who are in the trenches in the public school system, trying to figure out, you know, if we have integration of all students in a single pool, then you're teaching to the middle or to the lowest common denominator by necessity. There's always some segment in there that isn't getting your best attention. I don't know what to do about that. I don't think anybody does. I know that, when I was in public school, I was in fully integrated classes very often. I was also in honors classes and in the international baccalaureate curriculum later in high school as well. And those more fancy pants classes are...
Is that a technical term?
That's how we say it. Those are really effective, you know, if mm-hmm. you're... If you're in a room where everybody there values ideas and you all want to argue about them fiercely all day, that's a lot more useful than being in a room where you might get beat up if you raise your hand. But I don't know what to do about it. You know, you can't. What are you going to do? Are you going to just dump all the students you don't like who are a little bit too much trouble over into metal shop not to downplay metal shop.
I went to metal shop actually.
Yeah, well, good for you. I could use more of those skills. But you can't just segregate the students that are too much trouble either.
So. Right. Well, listeners, if you have a story about how you were shunted into metal shop for asking questions or not, do call 780-492-2577 or email live at skepticallyspeaking.com. And continuing on the topic of schools, actually, the Wikipedia article on Junior Skeptic mentioned that teachers are using the magazine in the classroom.
Yeah, we only know that anecdotally.
Okay.
People write to us and say so. It's always a wonderful thing to hear. TAM this year was especially nice for me that way, that over the last couple of years, a lot of people have come up and wanted to talk to me about the kind of manifesto stuff, but that's just a tiny fraction of the work that I've done over the last few years. Most of the hard work is... because it's over in the kiddie section, people don't talk about it that as much, but that's where most of my effort goes. And quite a few people wanted to come over and talk about that this year, talk about how much their children enjoy it or how much their students enjoy it. I hear from students sometimes as well, from around the world. It's neat getting questions from Africa or Australia out of the blue. I love the future. It's totally neat.
Oh, I love that. So do you think that you would want to pursue a more, I guess placing the magazine formally in classes?
Could you repeat the question?
Do you think you'd want to pursue trying to get Junior Skeptic into schools on a more formal basis rather than just teachers sneaking it in their bags?
Oh, well, we try and make it so it's not off-putting for teachers. We don't go near religion.
Right.
Except in a few cases, I've said the pyramids were X many years old when Jesus lived, kind of thing, just for date context.
Right.
We don't go near religion. We don't go near other valued Christmas stories. We stick just to the monster stuff and psychics and paranormal stuff and straight science.
Right.
The curricula for school, that's industries within industries just to serve that. And in a different set of industries in every state and every province and every country, it's a specialized set of expertise wrestling anything into a curriculum.
Definitely. Actually, we have an email question.
Super.
This is from Nathan. My roommates have a 7-year-old daughter. We get along well, and she calls me Uncle Nathan, which is fun. However, I find myself wanting to correct the woo that her parents tell her without causing waves. Do you have any suggestions?
That's an extremely tough one. I mean, every skeptic is familiar with this. It's twice as sensitive with somebody's kids, but like, you know, you go to a cocktail party and I kind of live in dread of somebody asking me what I do. You speak up in a group of five people and you offend somebody no matter how careful you are. Around other people's kids, you want to be very, very careful. That's the main advice I would give. I can't address the question very well because I don't know specifically what they've been teaching their child. I would note that I do discourage use of the word woo. I think it's just not terribly respectful.
Good point. Let's talk about some of the best ways for parents or, you know, any adult really to encourage critical thinking skills in their kids.
Well, I think it, one of the foundational places to start is just honesty. With my own child, I've made a, you know, when you talk to your kids, you can't tell them everything. There are age appropriate ways to describe things, but I try not to use knowing falsehoods. I try not to say, I think we're out of ice cream, when I know that we're not.
Right.
So establishing yourself as a credible source, that's number one. Number two is taking your kids seriously as thinkers. They have to listen to you, but you have to listen to them too. This means being aware of the slower rate at which they digest a piece of information. You know, you have to parse your conversation out in smaller pieces and wait for them to process it. It begins with honesty and respect, and knowing what you're talking about yourself really helps.
What about a situation like Santa Claus? Because there's so many differences in the way people deal with something like that, including the way skeptics deal with it.
Well, Santa Claus is a question I get so often that I actually added it to the FAQ on skeptic.com in the Junior Skeptic wing. My position is that it is a wonderful piece of Christmas magic, which is best left for parents, and I don't deal with it in Junior Skeptic at all.
If I can just ask, now you're a father, how are you dealing with it?
Well, I think every skeptic wrestles back and forth with this, but trying to stay away from knowing falsehoods and sticking to just a sense of wonder and imagination. I don't think any skeptic should recommend crushing the imagination of our children.
No, and I agree. Well, there's sort of the two sides. There's the, you know, you're going to ruin their childhood argument, but the other side is, I guess that's their first useful lesson in teaching them to doubt. Unfortunately, though, it's usually, you know, you're forced to doubt what your parents told you.
Well, there may be kids in the audience right now. It's an interesting topic. It's a difficult topic for a lot of parents. But you know, one of the nice things about being a kid is that they're able to exist simultaneously, in a kind of Necker cube or, you know, like waking dream kind of state between ordinary everyday reality and the world of their own imaginations quite comfortably. They can enjoy both simultaneously. So I don't think it's an either or proposition. I think you can kind of muddle around the intersection there. And that's what we try to do in our family.
All right. Well, other opportunities for skeptical education. You heard of Richard Dawkins Kids Camp, correct?
I know that there are many camps. I don't actually know about the Dawkins one. The CFI has one, of course, Camp Inquiry. But yeah, fill me in. Tell me.
Well, Times Online put it this way, and I'm going to read it verbatim. Give Richard Dawkins a child for a week's summer camp, and he will try to give you an atheist for life. The author of The God Delusion is helping to launch Britain's first summer retreat for non-believers, where children will have lessons in evolution and sing along to John Lennon's Imagine. The five-day camp in Somerset, motto, It's Beyond Belief, is for children aged 8 to 17 and will rival traditional faith-based breaks run by the scouts and church groups. Budding atheists will be given lessons to arm themselves in the ways of rational skepticism. There will be sessions in moral philosophy and evolutionary biology, along with more conventional pursuits such as trekking and tug-of-war. There will also be a 10-pound prize for the child who can disprove the existence of the mythical unicorn. Now, I think that sounds super fun. But is it just me, or does that write-up sound a little bit snarky?
It does sound snarky. Now, okay, I'm involved professionally with the intersection of skepticism and education. So I hesitate to talk too much about the work of our colleagues at other organizations.
Oh no, I think it's a brilliant idea for a camp. I'm thinking that it's I'm just wondering if this is. When we are open about wanting to teach children about rationality and about humanism, are we supposed to just expect that people are going to be snarky about it?
Well, okay, dealing with the camps, I'll make the note here that I don't know very much about those projects. I haven't seen them. I don't know how they feel or how effective they are, or you know what their kind of experience they are for kids or for parents. But I do wonder about them. I wonder, first of all, are they a good use of resources? You know, like if you're, they could be revenue generating. I don't know, but you know, are they good? A lot of attention goes into a camp like that, which may only serve, you know, 10 or 20 or 100 or 200 students. The same amount of human effort could go into an awful lot of podcasting or writing. So that's one thing I wonder. The other is that it is snarky. I've argued often, and this is contentious in the skeptics world, but I argue that skepticism should be quite distinct from humanism and from atheism. Mm-hmm. First of all, because it's just a demographic reality that there are a lot of religious believers who are part of the skeptical movement and want to help us do our work, and we should not be alienating those people. But when I take off my professional skeptics hat, when I speak as a secularist, as a humanist myself, even then, I'm not totally comfortable with that concept, but I would have to see how it feels on the ground. One thing I would note is that the kinds of parents who will send their kids to those camps are already going to be raising inquiring minds.
That's a very good point, actually. We have another email. Go ahead.
This is from Paul. All I really learned in public school is how to take tests, and that conformity is a good thing. I learned that we are only as important as our clothes and our haircuts, and that being smart and wanting to learn is not necessarily a good thing. I want more for my son, if he ever stops teething. How does Daniel feel about a hybrid education system, or one that would use a voucher system that would allow me to send my son somewhere with more skeptical, in my case, libertarian bent, while allowing parents who wanted just the basics or their religion to be featured, or even a metal shop-based education to do so? Should the government be primarily responsible for teaching our kids, or should we, as parents, have more say? Cheers, Paul.
Well, that's a lot of meat there. Yeah, that's a number of topics all rolled into one there. One, I should say first up, I don't care how education is delivered. In some sense, it's already a hybrid system. If you go to your typical high school, it may well be that there is a private contractor who provides the food. You know, Coca-Cola provides the vending machines. It's already hybridized to some degree. And, you know, somebody else, some other corporation makes the pencils and the paper and all that stuff. Could a private enterprise provide high-quality teachers? Sure, lots of private enterprises do. What I care about is, first of all, access, which has to be universal. My parents, if my parents are too poor or too stoned or too mean to send me to school, they should not be able to take away my liberty to the extent that I don't have access to basic literacy. So that's one failing of the kind of libertarian proposals for education. But again, I don't really care how the services are delivered as long as they're good and they're delivered to everybody. excuse me. I would note that often when these arguments come up about vouchers or choice, they're really code words for I want the right to teach children my supernatural beliefs in school.
Right.
So you know, in that sense, the libertarians and the creationists are kind of strange bedfellows.
Ooh, you know that's that's right now they're twitching, both groups right now.
I suppose so, and yet it's common, you know, like the Discovery Institute or the Templeton Foundation, they have a joint mandate, the free market and promotion of religion.
Well, on that note, actually, let's do a couple of announcements. So Paul has actually just called, and he actually emailed in an event this week. On Sunday, September 13th at 10 a.m., thousands of Edmontonians will be attending church services. A significantly smaller number of people, namely members and supporters of the Society of Edmonton Atheists, will be cleaning a 3-kilometer stretch of Highway 2 northbound just past the airport overpass. According to Society President Paul Welke, we feel that starting a social organization for local atheists was a really good start to making Edmonton a more attractive city, but we felt that we could do more. So if you would like to participate, more information is available by joining the Society of Edmonton Atheists Facebook group or by sending a Facebook message to the president, Paul Welke, and that's Welky. Also, something interesting going on. The Skeptical Blog Anthology is looking for entries. In an attempt to bring awareness of skeptical blogs to the masses, the young Aussie skeptics want your blog posts. They plan to collect the best ones and then provide a text-based resource to classes in general readers. What I think that means is they're making a book out of blog posts. And I love that because someone's got to look out for those of us without iPhones or Kindles. So thank you, young Australian skeptics. You can nominate your own post or your favorite skeptical blogger, and there are guidelines and more info over at youngausskeptics.com/anthology. That's youngausskeptics.com/anthology, or email youngausskeptics@live.com. So continuing to talk about skeptical resources here, we have a few minutes left if anyone wants to email in. So one of the things that I think when we're talking about skeptical resources, being a good skeptical role model is a resource. It's a resource in itself.
I'll tell you who my skeptical role models are. There are people like Eugenie Scott over at the National Center for Science Education. There are people who are nice to the people they're talking to and who understand that a slightly different parallel universe would be one where I believed in homeopathy. You know, it's
right.
The people who are good skeptical role models are the people who actually listen to their interlocutors and who are respectful and start there. That's you know, respect is just the bottom line. You can't persuade anybody, you can't teach anybody, you can't reach anybody unless you're willing to actually have genuine conversations.
Well, and that's a really good point. How do you suggest that we balance teaching respect for other people's beliefs and the ability to question?
Well,
because
I mean,
that does end in conflict, a lot of times.
Well, I'd say, you know, for the first rule would be everyone who's listening right now, take a look inside yourself and just ask, do I ever mock people who don't share my beliefs? And if the answer is yes, stop it. Just cut it out. You know, you can question them. You can combat fraud. You can get work done without sinking below the standards of civility, because you're less effective if you do. You know, apart from just being ethically right to be nice to people, and also in keeping with my personality, I'm not terribly conflict oriented. It is strategically, it is the most effective course.
And so this is part of that framing discussion that the skeptical community loves to have.
Well, I suppose so, but I mean, you can frame it in any way, and if you say it in a mean tone of voice, your point is going to be lost.
That's a very good point. actually, my son's father has continually been uncomfortable with the fact that I not only taught our son how to argue, but that I encourage him on how to argue. Because it's, you know, and you can't. Yeah, sometimes that works against me, obviously, but I think right. It's a good principle. But there's a difference between doubting and debate and actual argument, and I think that's really difficult to tell to explain to children.
Well, I mean, for anyone who is like kind of by personality a little bit of an intellectual when they were a teenager, most of those people, like myself, will remember being a big jerk with your ability to argue. That's really common, but you know, people grow out of it, and if you get a good foundation, and they grow out of it.
Not all of us grow out of it. We try.
I have noticed that about you. Very antagonistic.
I try to be nice. But on that note, we are out of time for today. Thanks so much to Daniel Loxton, editor of Junior Skeptic Magazine.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for bearing with our technical issues. We are in a community radio station. I'd like to point out that we are going to have our big annual fundraising campaign next month. And so remember this when I'm asking you for money, people. There are reasons for it.
Yeah, I don't mind. I did college radio, and we were always one step away from the station bursting into flames.
I know. Every single show.
Yeah.
So if you want to check out more about Junior Skeptic, go to skeptic.com, click the tab at the top of the page that says Junior Skeptic, and it's quite easy to find. And there's a big picture of Scooby-Doo on it this week, so very easy. Thanks to Mike and Jarrett for sound. They just gave me a look like that. I don't even want to talk about it. And thanks to Brad for speaking up. And you can find Brad's blog at skeptad.com. And as per usual, head over to skepticallyspeaking.com if you want to continue the conversation. You can subscribe to the podcast version of this show in iTunes. And that's funny, guys, because that's all the skeptical goodness, but minus the swearing and technical difficulties. And you get to hear the closing song, Everything You Believe Is a Lie, by The Burning Hell in its entirety. And we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
South America does not exist. Moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall up, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our body don't rot when we die. Oh, the hippies are working for the government, and everything you believe is a lie. Thank you. inside your TV.
And nobody cares when you cry.
Your mother resents you. She wanted a girl.
And everything you believe is a lie.